from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Just yesterday in Washington, President Obama said he's scaling up U.S. military pressure on ISIS to squeeze them and defeat them, he said. My guest today, global strategist Andrew Bacevich, says stop. We've effectively been in one long war in the Middle East for decades, he says. It's hurting us, he says. It's time to end it. This hour on Point, Andrew Bacevich on where the U.S. went wrong and the need to leave war in the Middle East behind. Later in this hour, we'll hear some pushback to Andrew Bacevich's arguments from Middle East expert Shadi Hamid. But first, joining me now from Orange County, California, is Andrew Bacevich. He's a retired U.S. Army colonel, professor emeritus of international relations and history at Boston University, a West Point graduate who served in Vietnam. His son, First Lieutenant Andrew J. Bacevich, died serving in Iraq in 2007. Andrew Bacevich is author of Breach of Trust and Washington Rules. His new book is America's War for the Greater Middle East. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Andrew Bacevich, welcome back to On Point. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Well, thank you for having me on.
A nearly 40-year war, you say, which means you take it back to what?
Take it back to 1980. Why? In January of 1980, Jimmy Carter used his State of the Union address as an opportunity to declare that the Persian Gulf had now become a vital U.S. national security interest, meaning a place that the United States was willing to fight for. And it's important to remember that up to that point in our post-World War II history, the United States had not been interested in fighting in that part of the world. Our military commitments, our chief commitments, were to Western Europe and East Asia. Beginning in 1980, that began to change. What Carter did, I don't think he appreciated the implications of this Carter Doctrine, but what he did was to initiate the militarization of U.S. policy, not simply in the Persian Gulf, but through large parts of the Islamic world, leading to that series of interventions, large and small, that you referred to.
Let's listen to that for a moment. Go back to 1980, State of the Union Address, President Jimmy Carter articulating, introducing what came to be known as the Carter Doctrine.
An attempt by any outside force to gain control of the Persian Gulf region will be regarded as an assault on the vital interest of the United States of America. And such an assault will be repelled by any means necessary, including military force.
President Jimmy Carter, 1980, the Carter Doctrine, touch the Persian Gulf, and you'll see the U.S. military. Before that time, my guest Andrew Bacevich points out scarcely any American military had died in the Middle East since World War II years. Since then, many have died there. Andrew Bacevich, many of us have watched all of those subsequent strikes and invasions and campaigns play out, but you are framing them as one great war, one long war in the greater Middle East. How do you sit back and make the case that these are not a series of interventions, rather a single long war?
Well, 2 points, I think. The first is that if we content ourselves with seeing them simply as unrelated interventions, then it becomes exceedingly difficult to come to some larger appreciation of how we ended up where we are, and quite frankly, I think any appreciation for the extent of our failure. So there is an analytical benefit that derives from grouping them together as a conflict. Beyond that, however, I think that it makes sense to consider them as constituting one war because the United States has attempted since beginning in 1980 to use the term that people in Washington like to use, that we've attempted to shape the greater Middle East, to somehow pacify it, to dominate it, to democratize it. You know, the words used to describe our purposes may vary from one administration to the next, but a threat of continuity has been the expectation that through the adroit use of military means, somehow or other, the United States is going to fix this region. And again, if we take on board the entire panoply of military activities that we've undertaken, we sure haven't fixed it. And I think arguably we actually have made matters that much worse.
I don't know how you would define the American motive in militarily intervening in the Middle East now. We'll look at that. But you're very clear about how you define the motivation from the beginning of this long, long chapter that you describe. And it goes to a certain understanding that Americans came to embrace of what freedom itself meant and how that tied into the number one resource of the Middle East.
Yes. I mean, on the surface, at the outset, this was a war for oil. But it was a war for oil because oil had come to be a symbol, the medium for exercising American freedom as Americans had come to define or understand freedom. But I would emphasize, and I try to emphasize in the book, it's not simply that we needed oil; it's that the expectation that somehow the United States, the great American experiment, had run into limits that we could not surmount was exceedingly difficult for Americans to accept. We see ourselves as a people to whom limits do not apply. And I think to some degree, never articulated this way, but to some degree, the war for the greater Middle East has been a war that's intended to demonstrate that we are, in fact, this exceptional, extraordinary, indispensable nation.
Trying to sort those two out. I mean, you recall driving into Chicago to pick up a girlfriend who would become your wife in a cherry red Mustang and that sort of a simple American joy of fill the gas tank, hit the road. And you recall it understanding very well just how, you know, that was a certain kind of freedom that felt pretty good to a young man in your shoes. Now you're saying this long intervention is tied up with a fundamental understanding of limitless American power or possibility. But why would that be projected onto this region, that need, that hunger? If it weren't
well, because in 1980, I mean, we have to get to the specifics, I think, of mm-hmm. what leads Jimmy Carter to make this commitment. Because in 1980, in January of 1980, the United States has sustained two great shocks. The one was the Iranian Revolution, the overthrow of the Shah, the disappearance of this valued ally at the time, the emergence in the Shah's place of a revolutionary regime. And the second event, of course, was in December of 1979, just a month before Carter's speech, was the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, which many in Washington interpreted at the time as evidence that the Soviets were on the march, that they were going to go from Afghanistan across Iran and seize Saudi Arabia. So much seemed to be at risk at that moment, and the expectation was that somehow – it wasn't clear how – but somehow a forceful articulation of American intent backed up by the threat of force would be able to reverse those tendencies. The argument that I present in the book says that what ensued was a willy-nilly variety of armed interventions, large and small, which seldom really connected to any sense of larger purpose and therefore produced a series of either failures, outright failures, let's say the peacekeeping mission in Lebanon in 1983, or successes that turned out to be something other than successes, let's say Operation Desert Storm in 1991. But never, when you put them all together, never has this military enterprise moved us closer to a region that is stable or more democratic or more favorably disposed toward the United States. The effort collectively has entailed enormous costs that we have paid and that, sadly, the peoples of the region have paid. So it just seems to me that it's time for us to, again, take stock of what we have attempted and draw some conclusions as to whether or not we're on track, we're headed to success. Should we just keep trying harder? Or is it perhaps time to consider some alternative to this militarized approach to policy?
The president said yesterday, and this president, Obama, who has not appeared to be as enthusiastic about military intervention, we're going to scale up on ISIS, we're going to squeeze them and defeat them. Is this different or part of the same long, in your view, conflict?
Oh, it's definitely part of the same long conflict. And let me try to be clear on my difference with the president. And it becomes a difference also with most of the candidates who are running to succeed Obama. Of course, it would be a desirable thing to have ISIS be defeated and removed, taken off the map. But then what? I mean, the presumption seems to be that if we destroy ISIS, then the problem solved? I don't think so. And indeed, that line of thinking reflects the refusal to take on board the larger historical context of our interventions in the region. So somehow or other, I think it's incumbent upon us as a people to begin to have a conversation to examine whether or not there are alternatives to just never-ending war in the Islamic world.
Andrew Bacevich's big, new, important book is America's War for the Greater Middle East. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Andrew Bacevich, please stand by. Listeners, you can join us. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with global strategist, U.S. policy critic, West Point man, Andrew Bacevich, about what he calls America's long war, permanent war for the Middle East. He says it hasn't worked. It won't work. It's time to end it and get out. His new book is America's War for the Greater Middle East. He joins us today from Orange County, California. Andrew Bacevich, can you take us through some of the iterations of the justification for significant military intervention in this region? It hasn't just been a steady state over time.
No, it has not. I'll try to answer the question by reminding listeners of the extraordinary range of methods that the U.S. military approaches, that the U.S. military has undertaken through this long series of interventions. You know, we have tried apply overwhelming force and quickly depart the scene. We've tried invade, occupy, and pursue political transformation of the occupied country. We've done humanitarian interventions. We've done peacekeeping. We've done punitive bombing, sometimes to intimidate, sometimes to try to bring about regime change. We've tried counterinsurgency. We've tried counterterrorism. We've tried decapitation. We've tried assassination. We've waged war through proxies. So there's been an extraordinary level of experimentation trying to find that approach to using force that will achieve our larger political objectives. And the successes, we've achieved some number of tactical or operational successes, but we've not been able to translate operational success into conclusive political success. And the purpose of war is to advance political objectives. And by that measure, the war for the Greater Middle East has been a costly failure.
I mean, you go all the way back to Reinhold Niebuhr warning Americans in the Cold War about dreams of managing history. You see the Middle East as a, particularly under George W. Bush, as an arena in which America hoped to prove that it was the irresistible Leviathan power. Go to the assumptions behind the notion that we could intervene and succeed.
Well, one of the most important of those assumptions, and it strikes me as still not sufficiently revisited, the assumption, especially coming out of the Cold War, you know, this really began to grip the Washington establishment around 1990, 1991, and that's assumption that we possess unquestioned military supremacy, not simply military capabilities. We have vast military capabilities, but somehow or other that American military power was irresistible, was an all-purpose tool. You know, if you think about the post-war period, post-World War II, which is when the United States chose to become a great military power, to acquire and maintain great military power. Mm. The thinking in the 40s, 50s, 60s was that the principal purpose of military power was to deter, to defend, to contain. Yes, in places like Vietnam, we departed from that that line of thought with terrible consequences. Mm-hmm. But the main purpose of maintaining power was to prevent war. When you look at the approach that the United States has taken in the greater Middle East and emphatically beginning in the 1990s, but as you suggest, even more so after 9/11, the thinking in Washington is that military power is an instrument to be applied actively to promote change of the sort that we desire. And the greatest illustration of that thinking, of course, is the George W. Bush decision to invade Iraq in 2003, a war of choice, launched with the expectation not simply that we were going to get rid of this bad guy Saddam Hussein, but it didn't getting rid of Saddam Hussein. We'd be able to change Iraq in a positive way. And that through that demonstration of our ability and will to achieve that in Iraq, that there would be further change in the region that would be promoted. You know, I cite it's really the most evocative quotation of the period is the comment that Donald Rumsfeld made in public on multiple occasions after 9/11, in which he said, "We have a choice. Either we are going to change the way we live," said Rumsfeld, "which is unacceptable, or we are going to change the way they live, and we choose the latter." Well, Rumsfeld didn't say – he didn't identify specifically who the they were, but it's pretty clear that the they referred to a very substantial portion of the Islamic world, that is to say the region from which anti-American jihadism emerged. That defines the – that's the ultimate expression of U.S. ambitions in the greater Middle East and the catastrophe – that resulted from that undertaking, that specific undertaking in the Iraq War, I think stands as a judgment of American thinking and of American naivete and of American arrogance with regard to the utility of military power.
Can we just take the first half of that Rumsfeld observation or assertion first? Either we're going to change the way we live or the way they live. I mean, cheap energy has been pretty key to the way Americans have lived for a long time. On that part of the equation, was he right that the link to a supply of energy out of the Middle East was essential to the way of life that many Americans have grown very attached to?
Well, I mean, this in a sense is the ultimate irony because back in 1980, where this story begins, there is no question that – the American way of life, as we generally understand the American way of life, this freedom defined in terms of consumption and mobility and the prospect of more tomorrow than we have today, that there was a direct relationship between that definition of freedom and our ability to access war in the Persian Gulf. Well, you fast forward to 2016 and guess what? That relationship doesn't exist anymore to the extent that whether for good or for ill, we still require boundless supplies of oil and natural gas. Guess what? There's plenty of it turns out, in the Western Hemisphere. And if indeed defending the countries from which we import oil and natural gas is a strategic priority, then it seems to me we should pay more attention to defending Canada and Venezuela than to Saudi Arabia and Iraq.
I want to dig into everything there, but take us right up to the moment in the ISIS challenge right now. The president just yesterday saying we're going to go bigger on ISIS. We'll squeeze them. We'll defeat them. It's pretty clear that you would not be for that, but ISIS can seem an awfully clear and present danger sometimes. And you know it's a strong political rallying cry very often to do something about it. How would you, with your get out and stay out approach, how would you address ISIS?
Well, I mean, if I may say, my approach is not get out and stay out.
Okay.
I mean, it's not that I'm an isolationist. It's not somehow that I'm advocating that we say, well, that we're out of that place. To heck with it. It's too much trouble. My argument is that relying on U.S. military power to try to shape the greater Middle East is something that we have tried now in a variety of ways, in a variety of places for several decades, and it hasn't worked, and therefore it's time to think differently. Alas, you know, the president in that article by Jeffrey Goldberg in The Atlantic that's gotten so much attention lately talked about his disdain for, I think what he called in the article, the Washington playbook. Well, there is a Washington playbook. And the president may not like the Washington playbook, but Washington is committed to this playbook. And the playbook really almost has one play. And the play is we need to figure out how to put our military to work to deal with the problem. And I would argue strongly it's time for us to create new plays, to think creatively about the possibility of American diplomacy leading to a different solution. What would that solution look like? I think when it comes right down to it, the solution to dealing with the specific and immediate threat posed by ISIS, which, by the way, does not pose a significant threat to the United States of America, but the way to address that is by having the nations of the region who are threatened by ISIS to recognize that they share a common interest in dealing with that threat. Were they to recognize that they have a common interest, I would argue strongly they could deal with it. Now, for them to do so, they would have to set aside their other grievances with one another, their other complaints about one another. And I think that the diplomatic challenge facing the United States, and I'm not for a second implying that this is somehow easy and we could do it by next Tuesday, but the diplomatic challenge is to nudge the countries in the region to recognize that they have a transcendent interest in addressing the ISIS threat. And were they to do so, the benefit to us would be to begin to create an opening that would enable us to move toward demilitarizing U.S. policy in the region, not abandoning the region, not walking away from the region, but backing away from the expectation that American military power provides a solution, because we have been experimenting with that notion for going on for decades, and it has not yielded the success promised by the policymakers who have continually sent U.S. forces into the region.
Of course, military presence, kind of defining element of American presence there for a long, long time. Too long, says Andrew Bacevich. His new book is America's War for the Greater Middle East. Andy, please stand by there. Joining us right now from Washington is Shadi Hamid, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. He was director of the research at the Brookings Doha Center in the Middle East until a year or two ago. His forthcoming book is Islamic Exceptionalism, How the Struggle Over Islam is Reshaping the World. Shadi Hamid, welcome to On Point. Thank you very much for being with us here alongside Andrew Bacevich.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
You must know Andrew Bacevich's argument. He has made it powerfully, and for a long time, he makes it very cogently in this big new book, America's War for the Greater Middle East. What do you make of his central assertion that the military approach to American involvement here is a failure and it's time to pull the plug on that, find a new way?
Well, I think this is an interesting time to have this debate because we've tested Andrew's approach over the past 7 years. President Obama is skeptical about the use of military force in the Middle East. He's tried very hard to disengage us from the region and disentangle us. So we can then look back over the past 7 years of the Obama era and empirically make the judgment, has this new way of doing things, of trying to take a step back, has it worked? And I think that we can judge rather conclusively that it has failed and in some ways failed miserably. And I think that's why we have to be careful about making this into an either-or proposition, that it's either the Bush-era massive military commitments or it's as little as possible. There's something in between, and that's where we have to find what that in-between is. And I think what we've learned with Obama's approach is not intervening can be just as risky and dangerous as intervening. And we see that very much in Syria, where in the absence of U.S. military intervention, more than 400,000 Syrians have been killed. So I think there's an important lesson there. And I would also say that Andrew correctly says, and I sympathize with this, that our allies should be the ones taking responsibility for their own region. But Obama has tried precisely that approach as well. I mean, if there's one organizing principle of the Obama doctrine, if you will, it's to step back, to let others step in, and we hope that our Arab allies will rise to the occasion. And what we've learned there is that that's failed miserably because our allies, unfortunately, don't share our interests. They don't share our values. They fight against each other. And we have essentially what we have now, which is endless proxy warfare. And this is what happens when there isn't U.S. leadership. Our allies fight among themselves, and we see more chaos, not less.
Shadi Hamid, stand by. We're looking at what my guest Andrew Bacevich calls America's long, long war for the greater Middle East. Andy Bacevich, what about it? Here's the case in point of the Obama years, and Shadi Hamid says they tried something like what you're suggesting, and it hasn't worked.
Well, we differ drastically in our interpretation of what the Obama administration's policy has been. I guess I'm not seeing disengagement. When President Obama came into office, he escalated, increased U.S. military involvement in Afghanistan. Since President Obama has been in office, he greatly expanded the use of missile-firing drones as an instrument of assassination. President Obama overthrew Colonel Gaddafi in Libya. President Obama's administration, with some frequency, bombs or raids Yemen and Somalia. President Obama has renewed the war in Iraq, the fourth Gulf War. So the notion that somehow we have tested an alternative approach and that it has failed strikes me as very much at odds with the actual behavior of the Obama administration. Not that I am defending that behavior, but the notion that he has attempted military disengagement simply flies in the face of the facts.
It's certainly not as many tanks rolling across deserts in the Middle East. There has been a sense, or at least rhetorically, everybody's asserting, many people asserting a kind of vacuum here. What about the proxy war proliferation that Shadi points to? It does look pretty messy right now.
Oh, there is no question that it's messy. I mean, why does ISIS exist? I mean, to some considerable degree, ISIS exists because of the folly of the United States in thinking that the application of military power can fix things. We created chaos in Iraq. Chaos and created the environment for these organizations to come into effect. So, you know, I don't adhere to the Washington playbook. The Washington playbook basically says, well, the response to failure is let's keep trying harder. And indeed, when we listen to the presidential candidates like Cruz, like Secretary Clinton, what we are hearing is advocacy of trying harder militarily, and what we are hearing is the utter, total, and complete absence of any willingness to take on board what the United States has achieved or not achieved militarily over the past 3.5 decades.
Andrew Bacevich, the new book is America's War for the Greater Middle East. Shadi Hamid, look for his Islamic Exceptionalism. Please stand by. We're looking at America's long, long war in the Middle East. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with global strategist, U.S. policy critic, West Point man Andrew Bacevich about his new book, America's War for the Greater Middle East. He says, too much American military for too long, and it has not worked. It's a detriment to the country's future, and it needs to end. Not all involvement, but the long, long military involvement. Enough already. He's with us today from Orange County, California. Shadi Hamid is with us from Washington, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Forthcoming book is Islamic Exceptionalism, How the Struggle Over Islam is Reshaping the World. the president just yesterday before a meeting with top military officials, saying he's looking for ways to scale up the fight against militants in Iraq and Syria, ISIS.
We are working to make sure that we're accelerating the campaign against ISIL in Syria, in Iraq. ISIL continues to lose ground. Coalition forces recently severed the main highway between ISIL strongholds in Raqqa, Syria, and Mosul in Iraq. And we continue to take on their leadership, their financial networks, their infrastructure. We are going to squeeze them, and we will defeat them.
Shadi Hamid, I've just got you for another minute. Andrew Bacevich disagrees with your characterization of the Obama administration as pulling back or scaling down militarily net-net. What's it going to take with ISIS? And if the U.S. really did withdraw militarily from this region, what do you foresee?
Well, first of all, I mean, the most important war in the region now is the Syrian civil war. And we did not, in fact, intervene against the Assad regime when we had the chance, 2012 to 2014. And I think we're seeing the unfortunate after effects of that. So that's the main example. But I think also the fact that we refuse to plan for the day after. So I don't, Libya isn't a mess today because of the original intervention. The original intervention succeeded in preventing a massacre. Where we went wrong was that the U.S. was very unwilling to continue engaging with Libya, and we immediately forgot about it. And on Andrew's point about why does ISIS exist, you know, when Obama came to power, he wanted to disassociate himself completely from Iraq, so Iraq became much lower on the priority list. We indulged the Maliki government, which became more authoritarian, and the U.S. essentially forgot about Iraq. That left a power vacuum, which ISIS would later benefit from. And because we weren't involved or didn't have any interest in doing anything about Syria, ISIS benefited from the vacuum there as well, and we're seeing the effects. So, I mean, part of this is, you know, how do you interpret what's happened the past year, the past few years? And it's very clear that we have a different interpretation. I would just say one last thing on what do we do about ISIS going forward. ISIS is not just a small threat. It's a threat to regional stability writ large in the Middle East. It's a threat to our closest allies in Europe. The refugee crisis that is resulting is threatening the EU as an entity. Western cities are being targeted on a regular basis. To not consider that a serious, significant threat, I think, would be a mistake. And the question is, as an international community, do we want to let an extremist proto-state in the Middle East expand or continue to exist and target our allies? I think the answer is no. ISIS does have to be not just contained, but defeated. So the fact that we in this country now are not willing to really have a conversation about more military, no one's talking about an Iraq-style invasion. We're done with that. That failed, and I agree with Andrew on that. But the fact that we're so unwilling to talk about doing more, and we can debate what that would entail, 10,000 troops, 20,000 troops, is that a good idea? Is that a bad idea? But the fact that we're so scared to even have that debate, I think, is a problem.
Shadi Hamid, author of the forthcoming Islamic Exceptionalism at the Brookings Institution, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Andrew Bacevich, take on that view of the world. You know that it has real political legs. It has again and again been an argument that Americans have turned to. There's a threat, it's vivid, it's in the Middle East, and we have to deal with it. There's no choice.
Let me try a little historical analogy, mm-hmm. Vietnam analogy. Late 1967, very beginning in 1968, there was a key question that was being asked about the Vietnam War at that moment. And the key question was, can the Marines hold Khe Sanh? You may recall, Khe Sanh was a Marine base in the very northern reaches of South Vietnam, surrounded by the North Vietnamese. The Marines are besieged, and everybody wondered whether the Marines would hold out, as if somehow or other the outcome of the war turned on that point. I think that's where the ISIS argument fits. It's an interesting question, but it's really not the most serious question. In late 67 and early 68, the question policymakers and Americans should have been asking is, does the Vietnam War make sense? Is the Vietnam War winnable? If it's not winnable, then why are we here? Why do we simply keep trying harder? So the conversation that we're having here, to the extent that when we let the concern about ISIS hijack the conversation, the effect is to preclude addressing questions that it seemed to me are far more fundamental. That doesn't mean that we ignore ISIS. It doesn't mean that ISIS is not some kind of a problem. But we ought to, at some point in this long military undertaking, get to first-order questions rather than becoming preoccupied with what's going on today.
What about the Syria example in that case? Shadi suggests, we didn't get involved there, and you've got 400,000 dead and millions of refugees and Europe potentially destabilized now, and says...
Well, I mean, it seems to me it's an argument that tries to have it both ways.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, well, gosh, we did try hard in Iraq, and that turned out to be a disaster.
Mm-hmm.
So Syria is unquestionably a disaster, but why does it... What is the logic that suggests that somehow... A more direct or comprehensive U.S. military engagement in Syria would have produced a different result than we got in Iraq or that we got in Libya. He kind of waves his hands as if we have no responsibility for the chaos in Libya. So again, what seems to me to be imperative here is not to become preoccupied with what are essentially operational considerations. What should our next intervention look like? What we ought to be doing is to taking a comprehensive look at what U.S. military engagement in the region has produced across the range of places where we have been involved, taking on board the variety of methods that we have employed and reaching some conclusions about the efficacy of American military power to this particular problem set. And I did not say that military power is not relevant here. I think it is. I'll go back to my earlier argument that it is the nations in the region who are facing a transcendent threat in the form of ISIS that need to step up to the plate.
So give us an alternative vision here because, again, as you know, again and again, the argument that we can't afford not to be in there has been very persuasive to the American public in American politics. It's rolled out plenty, even now, around ISIS. Go back
to... I think the alternative argument also then has to... If we retain the 1980 perspective that our freedom, our prosperity, our security are at risk in the Persian Gulf, then the argument gets won by those who insist that we have no alternative but to try harder. If, however, we consider the ways in which the world has changed since 1980, and I already mentioned one of them, that's the change in the energy environment.
Mm-hmm.
But there are other changes. I mean, it seems pretty clear to me that the big game of the 21st century is going to be played out in Asia. Whether or not we're able to nurture a reasonably stable balance of power in Asia, as these new powers like China and India reach maturity, man, that's a big question. That's the question that will determine whether or not we enjoy freedom, security, and abundance. And the global issues, climate change, that's a question that deserves far more attention than we have. So to the extent that we overstate the importance of the Persian Gulf to the United States, then we've got less time, less energy, less intellectual firepower being directed to a broader problem set that I would argue has come to be of far greater importance.
I've been keeping all kinds of callers waiting to speak with you, Andrew Bacevich. Dolores is calling from Waterford, Pennsylvania. Dolores, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Okay, a couple of questions. Tom, Colonel Bacevich, it is safe to say that because of the decades-long presence of the U.S. in the Middle East, leading by the nose, if you will, that has handicapped those countries in attempting to resolve their own problems, and that the fact that the debacle of March 2003 not only has engulfed the Middle East, creating more problems, but also has engulfed the European continent because of this large refugee flow we have now and the bombings that are taking place. And Tom and Colonel Basevich, thank you for being two of the smartest guys on the planet.
There you definitely go too far on my part. But,
me too.
But buying the U.S. leading countries by the nose that may not be able to fend for themselves right now. One more right here. Mudafer in Quincy, Massachusetts. Mudafer, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hello, Professor Biosevich. I want for once to have a patient to listen to me as an Iraqi-American who lived through the decade of the 80s and read the condition of American policy or the cause of American policy in the region. I mean, first of all, the Iraq-Iran war was basically a proxy that done on behalf of the United States. Saddam Hussein was pushed to attack Iran to gain or to stop the Iranian revolution at that time. ISIS is not something that was born yesterday. ISIS was born back in the 80s when the Saudi and the American, along with the Pakistanis, was training and helping the Mujahideen to fight the atheist Soviet occupation of
Afghanistan. Mudafer, we can't recite all the history. I'm sorry for that. What's your bottom line? What's your point?
Bottom line is accountability. We need to read the situation through kind of accountable historic reading.
But does that mean the United States should stay involved militarily to be accountable or to go?
The argument that whether the United States should disengage or engage is irrelevant because it's already engaged and it cannot leave the region the way it is. And
Mudafer, thanks for your call. And Debasevich, a call there from an Iraqi-American for accountability, and including the U.S. can't leave it the way it is.
Well, this is an argument that I think is frequently made, and it strikes me as an odd argument. There's a moral component to the argument that that he made that we need to talk about, we should not ignore. But this notion that we have no choice, we are in fact the most powerful country in the world. Power confers choice. I simply reject the notion that there is no alternative but to press on. I think those who make that argument are in effect confessing their absence of creativity to think differently. And certainly there's that absence of of creativity in spades in the national security establishment in Washington. But as to the moral aspect of accountability.
The Pottery Barn rule almost. You broke it, you own it.
Well, that's real. And yet, again, does it necessarily follow that moral accountability should lead to yet more military action of the sort that caused the problem in the first place? Again, absence of creativity. Let's take the Syrian civil war that was briefly referred to before. I don't know to the extent to which we should somehow view our U.S. policy is somehow responsible for the refugee crisis, but there is a refugee crisis. Okay, let's do something about it. One alternative is send in U.S. forces to fight in Syria. I oppose that. Another alternative is let us open our doors to considerable numbers of these Syrian refugees. Let us take in our fair share. Let us follow the example of Chancellor Merkel in Germany. Why not consider that alternative if indeed we are serious about addressing the moral accountability that stems from our earlier actions?
Andy, paint a different picture for us because, as you point out, we've been in this so long. I would say so long it's hard for Americans to see things differently. Paint a picture where the U.S. is not involved militarily. We've got 2 minutes here. But yet there's the possibility of a non-apocalyptic future for this future that is not bad for the region, not bad for Europe, not bad for the USA. What's it look like?
Well, as a preliminary response, let me say that the purpose of my book, the subtitle of my book is A Military History. The purpose of the book is not to try to foresee the future. The purpose of the book is try to get people to understand how we got where we are. But I do think that there is an alternative future that looks like this, and I will credit President Obama with at least putting this possibility in play. And the future is one in which some sort of equilibrium in the region emerges based on an agreement between powers in the region to tolerate one another's existence. And when I say Obama's put that into play, I think that's the real purpose of the Iran nuclear deal. Purpose, the notion of preventing Iran from getting a nuclear weapon was a factor driving the policy. But the real aim, in my judgment, is to bring Iran in from the cold, to recognize that there can be no equilibrium of power in the region unless Iran is a participant. Obama is giving Iran the opportunity to demonstrate that it can be, if it chooses, to be a responsible stakeholder. Now, there would be those who would say, well, listen to what the Ayatollah has to say. He's not going to be a responsible stakeholder. I would argue that Iran is changing. There is a new, younger, pro-Western Iran emerging, and it may well be that Iran can be that responsible stakeholder. It's going to take years to find out.
And above all, Andrew Bacevich says, look at our own military history there to learn perhaps what has not worked, what perhaps cannot be done. It's a powerful book. It's a great read. I recommend it highly. America's War for the Greater Middle East. Andrew Bacevich, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.